We come back again this evening to our sort of parenthetical mini-series on biblical justice here in the middle of our larger series on the book of Micah. This is our fourth sermon on this topic, which we have paused on here in our study of Micah. As we seek a better biblical understanding of societal justice and our responsibility in it, we are doing that so that we better know how to apply Micah's words about societal injustice to our own lives as we read of his discussion of that in this book. To give a bit of a recap again, in our first sermon on the subject back in May, we observed that we do not currently as a society have a shared vision of what societal justice really is. We looked at how the most common theories of justice around us, postmodern or critical theory, the utilitarian theory, the liberal theory, and the libertarian theory, are all ultimately rooted in secular humanism. In the second sermon, we began to consider a biblical theory of justice rooted not in some principle or some aspect of human nature, but in the character of God himself. Within God's character, as described in the scriptures, we especially focused on two major aspects of God's justice: his retributive justice, by which he renders just punishment to those who do evil, and his remunerative justice, by which he gives good rewards to those who do good. From there, we noted that God's justice, both his retributive justice that punishes evil and his remunerative justice that rewards and protects good, is supposed to be present in society as well. Neither comes about naturally in a fallen world, and so both must be sought intentionally. Which led then to our third sermon on this topic, which focused on corporate responsibility for justice. The fact that we are responsible to work for justice not only in our individual lives and our individual actions, but we are also responsible to advocate for justice in the communities and the society that we are a part of. And we considered six theses on this topic, concluding with the fact that while the topic of corporate responsibility is complex, at the end of the day, biblical justice still calls us to work for justice in the communities and the society that we're a part of. Which led then to the question of how we are to do that. We, as we noted, are not kings or queens. We can't unilaterally make things happen. And so how are we to proceed with this calling as ordinary members of institutions and ordinary citizens of our country? What are our next steps? That's the question that we will begin to address tonight. But we'll only begin to address it, unfortunately. Based on 12 action items given in Tim Keller's recent articles on justice, which I've been drawing from in this series and will continue to draw from tonight along with several other resources, I was planning to end this mini-series on justice this evening by summarizing those 12 together. Not surprisingly, it turned out to be a bit more than I could handle in one sermon. And so I'll try instead to cover the same ground in three sermons. Tonight we'll seek to answer the question, where and who? And next time we'll ask when, and then for the final sermon we'll address the question, how? And so tonight we consider where and who. Where are we to work for justice? And who is to work for justice? With those questions in mind, let's hear now from our text, Micah chapter 3, verse 1 through chapter 4, verse 5. Our sermon tonight, we should note, is a topical one, but this text will provide us with something of a starting point. And so please do listen carefully. This is God's word for us this evening. And I said, "Hear, you heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice? You who hate the good and love the evil, who tear the skin from my people and their flesh from off their bones, who eat the flesh of my people and flay their skin from off them and break their bones in pieces and chop them up like meat in a pot, like flesh in a cauldron. Then they will cry to Yahweh, and he will not answer them. He will hide his face from them at that time, because they have made their deeds evil. Thus says Yahweh concerning the prophets who lead my people astray, who cry peace when they have something to eat, but declare war against him who puts nothing in their mouths. Therefore it shall be night to you without vision, and darkness to you without divination. The sun shall go down on the prophets, and the day shall be black over them. The seers shall be disgraced, and the diviners put to shame. They shall all cover their lips, for there is no answer from God. But as for me, I am filled with power, with the spirit of Yahweh, and with justice and might, to declare to Jacob his transgressions and to Israel his sin. Hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, who detest justice and make crooked all that is straight, who build Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. Its heads give judgment for a bribe, its priests teach for a price, its prophets practice divination for money, yet they lean on Yahweh and say, "Is not Yahweh in the midst of us? No disaster shall come upon us." Therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed as a field, Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house a wooded height. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of Yahweh shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and it shall be lifted up above the hills, and people shall flow to it. And many nations shall come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples, and shall decide for strong nations far away. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. For the mouth of Yahweh of hosts has spoken. For all the peoples walk, each in the name of its God, but we will walk in the name of Yahweh our God forever and ever." This is the word of the Lord. So we begin this evening with the question of where. Where are we to work for justice? And our answer will be first in the church and then in the world. Now, there are other tendencies that are out there. Some folks want to restrict the work of justice to the church because they conclude that the world is going to hell anyway, and so why bother? Let's just focus instead on making the church as good as we can. Now, of course, as we already considered this morning, the church does not exist just for itself. The church is sent out in mission. And as promised to Abraham, our presence is supposed to be a blessing to all families and to all nations, as we seek to love our neighbors, and in doing so, point to God's love and his mercy and his justice. Other folks tend to want to restrict the work of justice to the church because they see the church as really too flawed to have much to say to the unbelieving world. But again, that perspective does not really fit with the scriptures themselves. The Bible is not shy in describing the flaws of the people of God. And yet, throughout their history, God still called them not just to improve themselves, but to work for the good of others. And God, again and again, worked through them even when they were deeply flawed. Still, other folks tend to want to focus the work of justice only on the world. In their mind, the church is actually doing pretty well, especially when compared to the world around them. And so when people point out injustices in the church, the response will often be to deny those claims, or just to point out that at least things are better in the church than they are in the world. And yet, this view is also out of step with the scriptures. It was a common observation in the Old Testament that the pagan nations around Israel were more sinful and more unjust than Israel was. And yet that did not stop God from bringing judgment on Israel using those very same nations. Being more just than pagans is not the standard that God has set for his people. And for that matter, we cannot just assume that the church is acting more righteously than the pagans of the world in every area of life. Even in the days of the Apostle Paul could state that the church in Corinth was tolerating sin that not even the pagans would have tolerated. And so we cannot limit our critiques of injustice to the unbelieving world. Instead, we must first work in the church and then work in the world, by which we mean that we are called to work in both, with our first priority being to work for justice among the people of God, and our next priority being to work for justice out in the world around us. And the church is supposed to be our first priority for a couple reasons. First, it is because we do have a greater responsibility to it. In Galatians 6:10, the Apostle Paul says to the church, "So then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith." For Paul, when it comes to doing good in the church or in the world, it's not one or the other, but it's both. It's everyone, he says. While at the very same time, he also says that it's especially the household of faith, because there we have an even greater responsibility. That's one reason why we have that order of priorities. But a second reason is actually one of credibility. How can we critique and try to change the world when we have not even gotten our own house in order? So we begin with the church, which means we need to begin by asking how we actually treat one another. How do we speak to and about one another? How fairly do we treat others in the church? And especially, how do we treat those in the church with less power? How do we, for example, treat the poor or those struggling financially? Are we generous? Do we seek the sort of remunerative justice that we see described in the Old Testament, where we give to the poor among us and provide for those in need as if the money was theirs by right, just as described in the gleaning laws we discussed a few sermons ago? And as you ask that question, don't stop and think about other people here. But what is your attitude towards the financial needs of others in the church? And what about other groups that tend to have less power? How do we treat women? Are they heard? Are their concerns treated as if they matter? Are their insights acknowledged as valuable? How do we treat those of other races among us? How do we react to other congregations that have a majority of people from a different race than we are? How do we respond to their voices? How do we treat their perspectives? How do we treat children? How do we care for them? After all, they are those with less power than the adults in the room in just about every situation. These should be concerns for us as we work for justice, for the biblical idea of justice rooted in God's character within our own church. Because working for justice in the church is to be our first priority when it comes to the work of justice. But then we also must work for those same things in the world. And we see something of that movement from the church to the world in our text. The text begins with God's people, with Israel, the church. In verse 1, we read, "Hear, you heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice?" In verse 2 and 3, Micah says that it is like the leaders of God's people are consuming God's people. They're eating their flesh, chopping them up like meat in a pot, he says. They care only for their own advantage, we read in verse 5. And so God will bring judgment, we read in the verses that follow, because there should be justice among God's people. But then in chapter 4, we see that the long-term plan is for that justice to extend. Now, there's a lot going on in those verses, and we're not doing a detailed exegesis of chapter 4 tonight, but just notice the overall shape. In verses 1 and 2, the people are coming into Zion, into the city of the people of God. And why? Well, because we read at the end of verse 2, "For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem." The just law of God goes out. In verse 3, we read that the judgments of God are bearing on the nations, even the nations far away. The shape of our text is one more reminder of God's calling for his people to bring the truth and justice that is rooted in God's character out among us and then out into the world. So where are we supposed to work for justice? First in the church and then in the world. That then brings us to our second question, who is to work for justice? Now, that might seem like a dumb question at first, because we've emphasized in the previous sermons that everyone is called to work for justice as they are able. And so what I mean is not really who in terms of persons, so much as who in terms of office or position or standing. Who in what sort of capacity is to work for justice? We might ask, is it mainly the pastor's job? or the elders, or the deacons? Should the deacons be putting funds towards political causes? Should the elders be leading legislative initiatives? Should I, as your pastor, try to run for governor? No. If the church is supposed to work for justice in itself and in the world, then in what capacity is the church called to do that sort of work? The church, in other words, in what form? That's the question we need to ask. And to answer it, we need to spend some time discussing two categories of the church that were developed and popularized by the 19th century Dutch theologian and political leader, Abraham Kuyper. And we need to talk about the church as institution versus the church as organism. Now, what follows will be rooted in Kuyper, though not every aspect of Kuyper's thinking on these categories, and also taking some critiques and refinements and adjustments into account from Herman Bavinck, Daniel Strange, and also Tim Keller. John Bolt summarized the two categories in Kuyper's thinking like this: the church as an institution is the body of Christ gathered around word and sacrament for worship and discipline, while the church as an organism is the body of Christ in the totality of its multidimensional vocations in the world. Now, we need to clarify that a little bit, I think. Kuyper draws this distinction out in part by considering the kind of metaphors that the Bible uses to describe the church. The first set he draws attention to are organic. The church is described as a tree, as a vine, as yeast, or as a body. God gives it life and growth, and the church is pictured as an organic thing. A second set of metaphors, he says, draws not from nature, but from the work of human hands. The church is described as a house, or a temple, or a city. It not only grows, but it is built. Kuyper sees in this distinction two aspects of the church. One is the life of the community of believers, the church as a living organism. The other is the church as an intentionally built and shaped and governed organization, the church as an institution. The two are distinct, but Kuyper notes that Scripture refuses to let them be separated. After all, the Bible also speaks of the church as living stones and plants that are sown intentionally by a sower. Now, we can debate Kuyper's exegesis of those parables, but even aside from those, that distinction seems both sound and helpful. There is a difference between the church gathered under its officers to receive the means of grace or the discipline of its elders on the one hand, and the church as a communion of believers gathered for some other purpose together or scattered about their callings in the world. And the roles of those two aspects of the church are not always the same. Kuyper explains that the church as institution is established to feed and to extend the church as organism. And it's precisely this role of nurturing the church as organism that renders the institution of the church absolutely indispensable, he writes. Now, this distinction is not the same as the distinction between the visible and the invisible church, but rather it's a distinction within the visible church. And so, for example, when you gather with other Christians in your home for fellowship, or meet with other Christians for prayer, or Bible study, or you form an independent Christian school with other believers, is that a gathering of, is that a ministry of the church? Well, yes, in a sense it is, even if there's not an officer of the church in sight. It's a gathering, or it's a work of the organic church rather than of the institutional church. And the organic church often has its own power dynamics as well. One of my professors in seminary liked to tell us that when we arrive at our first pastorate, we may think that because of our degree or our ordination or our installation to church office that we have the power. But he said usually there will be some older woman in the church who has taught Sunday school to every second grader for the last 40 years or so. And the fact is that she is much more powerful than you are. What did he mean? Well, the pastor may have the formal power in the church as an institution, but a woman like that has the informal power in the church as an organism. And that kind of informal power often trumps formal institutional power. All of this helps get at the distinction between the church as an organism and the church as an institution. How then does this all apply to the question of working for justice? Well, the question for us is, which form of the church is the one that's supposed to do that? Which form of the church is called to actively work for justice, first within the church and then within the wider world? Let's start by considering work for justice within the church itself. Is that the responsibility of the church as institution or the church as organism? Well, in most cases, it would seem to be the responsibility of both there, ideally both working together. Both the pastors in the session and also the congregation as a whole have a responsibility to work towards our church gatherings and our institution being places of justice. And ideally, those aspects of the church would work together, each contributing to that work. Let me give a real example of that right now in the life of our church. Let's spend a few minutes thinking about our revised child protection policy, which is just now going into effect this fall. Now, first, a disclaimer about what I'm not saying as we talk about this. I know that some folks have struggled with some of the aspects of the new policy, and some folks have given us negative feedback or constructive criticism. I'm not saying that those folks don't care about protecting children from abuse, and I'm certainly not saying that those folks don't care about justice either, not at all. Some of the constructive criticism has been very helpful, and all of the dialogue is also helpful for us. In fact, that sort of dialogue is one of the points that I'm trying to make in what follows. And so my example is not meant to be a veiled criticism of anyone, but it's more about what our goals have been with the policy and also how the process has worked between the church as an institution and the church as an organism. Now, there are a lot of reasons we have sought to revise our old policy. The change was not brought on by an incident or anything like that, but by a recognition that we could improve the policy that we already had. There are several benefits to doing this. One is that a more set policy helps visitors and people new to the church who don't know everyone personally yet. It helps them feel more comfortable entrusting their children to our ministries. Another is that such a policy protects our volunteers from the possibility of false accusations themselves. Those are both important things. But neither one is actually the main motivator. The main motivator, in a sense, is seeking justice. Child abuse is, of course, a real issue. It's an issue out in the world. It's an issue in the church at large. And part of our responsibility to do justice is to do what we can to provide a safe environment for children. That's something we owe them according to a biblical concept of justice. We're called to care for all people, but especially to care for those who cannot defend or cannot speak for themselves. And children often fall into that category. And so part of how we work for justice is, to the best of our ability, to protect children from abuse in our church and in our ministries. And so our approach on this issue is, I think, a justice issue within the church, which is why it's also interesting to consider how these revisions came about. If my memory serves correctly, it began with input from the church as an organism. Some of us elders and pastors began to hear from congregants about ways that we might further improve our child protection policies and procedures. That's in a lot of ways what got the ball rolling, the organic church seeking more robust protection of justice in conversation with the institutional church. Around the same time, more or less, a similar process was going on a larger scale in the church at large. Advocates and organizations, expressions, in other words, of the organic church, have, over the past few years, been coming to denominational leaders, the institutional church, and explaining to them the risk and prevalence of child abuse in the church broadly, and advocating for best practices in the church. Organizations like Grace, founded by Boz Javidian, Billy Graham's grandson, or the work of Rachel Denhollander in conversation with church leaders like Al Mohler. These are just a couple of examples of where this has taken place. In a similar way, in our own denomination, in 2019, our General Assembly hosted a seminar by Ministry Safe on the topic of child abuse within the church, in which the attorney, Kimberly Norris, discussed abuse within the church and presented us with statistics and case studies and discussion of the effects on victims and the ways that churches and church leaders often miss abuse when they're not educated on it and when good policies are not in place. Along with the story again and again about how each church where it happened never thought it would happen to them. Because of this ministry of the organic church, we leaders at General Assembly of the institutional church walked away with a deeper understanding of what seeking justice in our settings would look like. With input from the organic church, both within our congregation and in a broader scale, the session, the church as institution, had begun the process of revising our policy. For help with that, we turned again to outside organizations for some help, organizations with more expertise than we have. But then we compiled a draft of our revised policy. The session reviewed that draft and then sent it out to others in the church, to Sunday school teachers and leaders of our women's ministry and others seeking input from them. As the institutional church, we were again seeking input from the organic church. And finally, after revisions based on an input, we brought the revised draft to the session as a whole, discussed it at length, and then adopted it. I'm sure as we go forward, there will be further revisions. I'm sure we'll continue to get helpful feedback. But our goal, however imperfectly it may be executed at times, is justice within the church. Protection for those who often cannot protect themselves. And the way that we have pursued that has not been limited to either the institutional church and the officers or the organic church through advocates within or outside of the congregation. Instead, it's been both aspects of the church working together. Because both the institution and the organism have a responsibility to work and to advocate and to make sacrifices for justice within our church. For the protection of the powerless. And of course, that often means sacrifices. And some of those sacrifices are tedious. Some are frustrating. But also, when I think of it, I know our administrative staff and our officers follow a lot of frustrating and tedious procedures to make sure we manage the money that's entrusted to us justly, to make sure it's not abused or misused. And so it seems that however frustrating it may be at times, it's not too much to add similarly tedious procedures to make sure we also manage the children entrusted to us justly, ensuring that they are not abused or misused either. And in both cases, the way that we do that well is with the combined work of the organic and the institutional church. That's one example and one framework as you think of what this looks like within the church. But then we come to the other part of our question. What about in the world? How is the church to advocate for justice out in the world? And it's there that we see more of a division of labor between the institutional and the organic church. When it comes to work out in the world and when it comes to bringing change to society, it is the organic church that is called often to the front lines. Kuiper argues, while the primary task of the institutional church is to make disciples and to form and to equip those disciples in such a way that they will go out and work for justice. And Kuiper, as he does often, uses a metaphor to describe this. The world, Kuiper stresses, is the arena. That's the battlefield. And he says, far from being that battlefield itself, he writes, the church is rather like the army tent of the Lord, where soldiers strengthen themselves before that battle, where they treat their wounds after the battle, and where one who has become prisoner by the sword of the word is fed at the table of the Lord. Kuiper is describing the church as an institution here, as something like an army tent, an army camp. It's here, in the institutional church, that soldiers come to have their wounds tended. Here is where the soldiers are educated to understand their goals and to understand their enemy. Here is where soldiers are trained for battle, and then having received that in the institutional church, the organic church goes out into the world to witness to Christ, to contend for the faith, and to work for justice. carry out the mission of God. That happens in many ways on the large scale of our lives. It happens, in a sense, on a weekly scale as well. We gather here on the Lord's Day, called together as the institutional church. Together as His people, we are cleansed by His grace. We are instructed by His word. We are fed at His table. He heals us and He binds our wounds. He trains us and He instructs us. And then He sends us back out. Out as the church, as organism, into our homes, into our neighborhoods, into our workplaces, into the world to do His work, which includes, among other things, working the work of seeking justice in the places that He has put us. When considering the church as an organism, Kuyper writes, "Above all, let our church not ignore the great social issues. The church especially must battle against sin. Especially the church has the calling to support the relative right of the lower class over against the spirit of the times. Let whatever is oppressed have the church's support." The church, as organism, is to be actively engaged in advocating for justice for those around us. When then turning to consider the church as institution, Kuyper exhorts the church officers, saying to them, "Building up the congregation spiritually, feeding her with the word of the Lord remains our first calling in every battle." There's something of a division of labor there. And that division exists for a few reasons. Some of it is practical. On a practical level, church leaders often lack expertise in areas where justice is needed. They may be able to point to the overall biblical direction of justice in a particular area of life or of society, but other Christians will often be more equipped than to do the work of the details needed on the ground. Another practical reason for this division is that without it, the institutional church can lose its direction. It can be taken up with these projects, and its work around the means of grace can get lost. Yet another reason for this division is that without it, the institutional church can become partisan. Even when Christians agree on a goal of justice, they can still disagree on the best way to get there. And so Christians can be on different sides of a political split, even as they work towards the same just goal. So it's usually best for the institutional church not to take partisan sides in such cases, but rather to equip its members, to equip the organic church to make those decisions themselves. This division will often mean that Christians join together to form separate organizations to pursue these sorts of things. And in fact, that's the sort of thing that we see in ministries like CareNet or the Tacoma Rescue Mission or a number of other ministries. Other times it may mean that Christians work with and within other organizations, maybe even non-Christian organizations, as what Francis Schaeffer called co-belligerence with non-Christians, working together for justice on a certain issue, even as they disagree on other, more ultimate things. Still, they find they can join together on that particular issue. But the point is that the frontline work is done by the church as organism. The church as institution doesn't need to draft a decree on the best way to address every social issue. It isn't called to fund political campaigns or organize political action. Rather, it's called to shape and equip disciples of Jesus Christ who then go out and do that work. Now, we should clarify, that doesn't mean that the church as institution is supposed to tiptoe around controversial justice issues. Not at all. We are to call sin, sin, and to call righteousness, righteousness. We are to speak in a way that equips believers to do that work in the world, providing a biblical perspective, a biblical worldview, and a biblical sense of urgency on the calling of the people of God in the world. But it does mean, at the same time, that the burden of that actual work falls largely on you. You need to ask if and where God may be calling you to do such work in the world and in the lives of those around you. It could be in ways that are big, or it could be in ways that are small. Now, at this point, we also need to note that this division of labor is not itself a law. It draws from theological concepts, and it seeks to draw from historic wisdom and insight, but it is not itself a law. There are exceptions. Sometimes there is overlap in a certain work. We, of course, run a school, which is not really a justice ministry at its heart, though it's not something that needs to be under church oversight either. Our denomination similarly runs a college and a seminary. And beyond our regular diaconal work, we as a church have run other mercy ministries that minister to the needs of others around us. None of that is wrong. All of that, I would say, is a good thing. But it's helpful to note that even in those cases, the officers of the church more often provide support and oversight for these ministries rather than running the details of them themselves as officers. There is a recognition that while it may be wise for the church to provide that support that helps the ministry go and that oversight that keeps the ministry on its mission, on the foundation of that support and under the umbrella of that oversight, the ministry often functions as a work of the organic church. The organic church within the institutional church. And that arrangement can function in a variety of ways and bear much fruit. Still, in other times, extreme circumstances may call for the church as institution to pursue justice in their setting in the world directly. Tim Keller notes that as important as the distinction between institutional and organic church is, even so, it applies, he writes, in different degrees depending on the state of society. In times of social crisis, such as Nazi Germany, the church necessarily must institutionally take political stands. That can happen often in times of crisis. And of course, some parts of the church have had to deal with more crisis than others. As Esau McCulley comments, the black church in America started in the time of slavery, continued through the era of segregation, the black church, he explains, has not had the luxury of separating their faith from political action. Our own Westminster Confession seems to acknowledge these sorts of exceptions. It doesn't deal with this question directly, but when it speaks to the role of church synods and councils, it says that such ecclesiastical bodies are not to intermeddle with civil affairs which concern the commonwealth. But then it adds that there are exceptions. When the church is asked for its opinion by the civil magistrates, but also when the institutional church decides that they must petition the civil authorities on an issue because it is an extraordinary case. While the confession is focused on synods and councils, a similar concept might be applied to the institutional church in general. Now, when it comes to those exceptions, what constitutes an extraordinary case? Well, that's a good question. It's one that is left to wisdom and invariably to disagreement. In this way, the division of labor between the institutional and the organic church when it comes to the work of justice in the world can feel a little bit how Captain Barbossa describes the Pirate's Code in the movie Pirates of the Caribbean. The code, he says, is more what you call guidelines than actual rules. And so these are not rigid theological rules. But they are wise guidelines, rooted in real theological distinctions and developed in the Reformed tradition as the church has struggled over centuries to carry out its mission in the world while maintaining its focus on the spiritual calling of the church around the means of grace. And so they are good default guidelines for us as well. When we get frustrated that the church is not endorsing a candidate in an upcoming election, or throwing its support behind the party platform we like, or pressing a specific policy initiative we think would be good for society, we should remember that that may be our role. And it may be the role of Christians working together as the church as an organism, but it may not be the appropriate calling for the church as an institution. And on the other hand, when we get frustrated that the church is talking about current issues and pressing us to think about the Bible's commands and how they apply to the social challenges of our day, and confronting us with how the Bible's concept of justice doesn't quite match ours, or bringing up struggles out in the world when we'd rather be thinking only of things like heaven, then we need to remember that it is the calling of the institutional church to equip and to train and to prepare the organic church to engage with those issues of justice in the world and to do it well. So as we think of all this together, where are we to work for societal justice? First in the church and then in the world. Who is called to that work? In the church as organism and the church as institution are to work together, both pursuing justice within the community of the people of God. In the world, ordinarily, the church as institution is to equip the church as organism to go out and to work for justice. That tells us where we are called to this work. It tells us who is called to do it. But then what sort of timeline should we expect when it comes to seeing progress? And how should we pursue the work itself? Those are the questions we'll return to in our next two sermons. Amen.